Accession number 9168, roll number 2.
Mr. Amat, reel 2. How long did you think the war would last?
Well, we had no... I personally had no idea, really, but all the papers and all the media sort of whipped everybody up into a sense of that it's going to be over in 6 months or going to be over in 12 months and all that, but nobody had a... All they wanted was to sort of... All us chaps wanted was to get in and try and help to end it as quickly as possible.
You said that after your route marches, you were left to your own devices. Could you give me some idea of your daily routine whilst you were training at Setford?
Yes, we used to do route marches. We used to do arms drill, physical training, and attend lectures given by the officers and the sergeants. And I remember one feature of our life. There was after the camp had been, we'd been in camp for about a month. Firm of builders came in and started erecting what we found out to be afterwards was a cinema built of corrugated iron on a steel structure, a little way away from the camp. And so that eventually, after a few weeks, when it had been constructed, we could go and watch a film. Of course, it was all silent in those days. And also in between the films we used to see was... some of the local talent, a chap would get up and sing a song or act as a bit of a comic and all that as an interlude, you see. I think that used to cost us tuppence, something like that, for a couple of hours entertainment. But it was all, the floor was just ordinary sand, like all the rest of that camp area was all sand. And I don't remember much. I think the seating accommodation was... rows of army 6 foot forms, which used to be used in all our camps in those days. And there was no, it was just a flat surface, so if you were at the back, you couldn't see very well. Anyway, it was a distraction from a normal routine.
What was relationship like between officers and men?
Oh, pretty good, because... you see, you were with the same officers all the time, more or less. And whilst I was there, so that I could get off of parades, I volunteered to become an officer's batman. And I served with one of the officers there, and that got a bit boring, so I decided to ask that I be returned to duty.
What were your duties as a batman?
Well, I used to have to get up in the morning at Rivalli and go straight to the officer's mess cookhouse and get a cup of tea and a biscuit, take it to the officer and wake him up at a certain time, and then clean his uniform, the buttons, brass buttons. That's another thing we used to have to do, you see, in the old days. When I first joined up, you got what they call a button stick. It was a piece of metal, usually, with a slide cut in it and a hole at the top where you push your buttons through there and rub them with a brush with some metal polish. Then after the officer had got up and gone to breakfast, I had to clean the tent out, make the bed and prepare... whatever uniform he wanted for the next parade. And I was excused all parades, of course, whilst you were a batman, and you more or less pleased yourself what you'd done during the day. But you had to keep the... then you had to prepare a bath for him sometimes. In those days, the camp equipment of the officer was all canvas. And it was made of canvas stretched over... wooden struts, very much like a deck chair arrangement. There was nothing. Oh, and you had to help in the mess in the evening at dinner, and sometimes at lunch as well. If they were short of waiters, they'd call upon the batman to take their turns at waiting at table. And that's another thing I learnt while I was in the service.
Why did you apply to leave batman's service?
Well, I got fed up with the routine of it. I'd have sooner been out with the rest of the boys rather than more or less left on your own all day long, don't know what to do with yourself. And that's what we did. But in October, when the weather started breaking up, we came out of the tents and went into the billets in Thetford town itself. And here I got another job away from duty, and I was more or less detailed for this job. I didn't volunteer to clean offices in one of the empty houses that was used by civilian personnel who were the clerical type, doing jobs that normal soldiers would do, but releasing them from their duty, you see. And we had to go there every morning, clean the offices, light the fires in the rooms, and generally make ourselves useful for anybody who wanted anything done. But, and after the weather started getting better in April 1916, they constructed, from where our camp was, lines of wooded huts, and we moved into them. Then we stopped there until June 1916, and then the whole camp moved to, the old unit moved to Harrogate in Yorkshire under canvas.
Had you heard any more at this point about your serving overseas?
Yeah, this was it. Nothing more at that time, but we were getting so fed up when we got to Harrogate. This lot of the chaps I was used to go with, we used to have sessions in it, each one's tent, discussing what we'd like to do and all that, you see. And anyway, one day somebody suggested what we should do is write a letter to the OC. This was just after the Battle of the Somme started in July, asking that we be included in a draft to go to France. And after a lot of discussion, they said, well, of course, you weren't supposed to do that because you're not allowed to write to the OC about your future and that sort of thing. But one of the bright boys suggested we send what's called a round robin. And that's a document with a statement on it, and it's signed in a ring at the bottom of it so that nobody's the leader. And that's what we've done. We got the clerk who was in the order room to draft a letter asking that we be included in a draft to go to serve overseas. And we all signed it, and this chap put the letter on the OC's table next morning. And for a couple of days we never heard anything. We're all hoping that nothing's going to happen, because we knew that they might take action and put us under arrest. And eventually they had us all on parade, and we had to go before the OC one morning. And instead of being marched in one by one, which we thought we would have been, they marched us all in together. And the OC read the letter that we signed out, and he first of all gave us a lecture about army regulations and that sort of thing. Then afterwards he said he thought it was very commendable, and he said he'd do his best to see that our wishes were carried out. Well, after that, the next day, all the people who signed this document were all separated from the rest of the battalion and put into tents in a separate area altogether. and we were put under intensive training of firing courses with a rifle and trench ship warfare and throwing hand grenades and bayonet fighting and all sorts of activities connected with training for war, you see. And then after about a fortnight, we passed these courses as they were then, and the OC and the officers put on a dinner for us, a farewell dinner, and we all sat down and had plenty of food and beer, free beer and everything, and then we were told that we were going to be posted away the following day. And the following day we all got all paraded and marched to the station at Harrogate, and from there we entrained and landed up the following morning in Southampton. That was August, I think it was, some date in August, anyway. And we spent the night in Southampton and then boarded a boat. Forget the name of it now. Anyway, we got on the boat about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, stopped there until it got dark, and then we went out into the channel and waiting for an escort, and went over and landed at Le Havre following morning. And we got off the boat and marched to the camp. It was about 3.5 miles away, actually, up a steep hill. And there we were under canvas with a huge base camp, this was in those days. There was all the regiments under the sun there. There was a guards cadres for the guards division, and all the London regiments were there. Drafts for waiting to go up, and people coming out of hospital and joining them, and all that sort of thing. And we spent about 3 weeks there, I think, intensive training. And one thing I remember about Le Havre was when you marched out of the camp each morning and went to this training area, which was some miles away, as you assembled, after you'd done all sorts of courses there of firing and drill and all that, you marched through at the slope through the camp area for about half a mile. And this area was lined with chaps we used to call canaries. They were sergeants and staff sergeants with their pace sticks under their arm, and I was watching every move as you went by, and they'd tap you on the shoulder if you were looking the wrong way, or any little, your arm wouldn't slope in the correct angle and all that. You all remember them, the canaries you used to call them. And after we'd been there about a fortnight, I suppose it was, we all got marching orders, and we had to get on a train to, well, in those days, those trains, there was no, I don't remember riding in a passenger train, they were a cattle truck. And they used to shunt you about, it took 5 days, I think, all told, to get up the front, and yet it was only, a few hundred miles, but there was such a chaos on the line and lack of rolling stock that you were lucky to get up there in 5 days. And we landed at a place called Mericourt, which was on the Somme. And we joined a battalion there. They'd just come out of the front and were on a rest. And we spent a few days there, and then we went up through the communication trenches up to the front line. We bivouacked a place called Trones Wood that had been the scene of one of the big battles on the first day of 1st of July. And we were just behind the British guns, the howitzers. And we spent some days there, and then we went up the front several times and held the front line at... I remember as we walked along through the communication trenches that had just been used and dug a few days before, you saw dead men and bit pieces of limbs sticking out of the trench. And well, to us, I mean, young soldiers, it was very disconcerting. Anyway, we on the day of the 8th of October, no, yes, the 8th of October, we went up, and each time that those troops used to go up the line, they used to have to carry certain other equipment besides the round. They'd carry a round of barbed wire or a coil of barbed wire or a couple of sandbags filled with rations tied in the middle and slung over your shoulder besides your own equipment. And you always, or duck boards you'd carry up. Everybody had to carry something up to the line. And anyway, we got to the point where we got out of there. There was no more communication trenches. And it was in the open. And it must have been about midnight then, because that's the time when the Jerrys used to shell. And as we went along, we were all scattered, in separated, you know, in line, so as to avoid any casualties. And you could hear these shells coming over, and were very terrifying, really. But I walked alongside another chap who'd been up before, more or less an old soldier, sort of what I was, and he said, don't worry about the ones you hear, it's the ones you can't hear. Anyway, we got to the end of the trenches, and then we had to cross an open ground because our platoon had been placed in the advanced trench a couple of 100 yards in front of the main trench. And we took up a position there, and I think we relieved the Worcesters. They went out that night. Anyway, the following morning, each one was taken in turns to do sentry, that stand on the fire step, while the others lay about in the trench as best they could and get as much rest as they could. Anyway, I was resting, more or less sitting on a... what was called a fire step in those days, but it was only very hastily constructed, very crude, and I must have woke up with a shock, and because when I looked round, there was a corporal in our platoon laying down in the trench with the he'd got one hand hanging off, and his face was all spattered in little pockmarked pieces of shell, and one ankle almost severed. And when I looked round farther, there was another chap who'd been sitting at the end of this fire bay, and his head was blown off. And what did that was one of the Jerry shells had come through, hit the parapet of our little bay, just at the back, just at the front where this chap was sitting, and come right through the parapet and taken his head right off and burst in the trench. But I was rather astounded because I wouldn't touch at all, and there were several other people wounded as well. As I had that training as a stretcher bearer in first aid, I started patching this chap up, made a tourniquet and stopped the bleeding. And then an officer came along and gave him a tablet of morphine The officers used to carry these things in their pocket, so anybody who was wounded, to take the pain away, they'd put this little, well, one of the tablets, like a sweet, and you put it on their tongue, and they sucked it, and it sort of sent them off into a unconsciousness, you see, to stop their pain. And we got this chap on a stretcher, and had to leave him there because the word come round that at 3 o'clock in the afternoon he was going over the top. And anyway, about 2 o'clock, the runner came up with a jar of rum, and the officer dealt out the issue of rum to every soldier, and and he told us that we were going over the top at 3 o'clock. And, well, we did go over the top. But at 3 o'clock, the officers looked at their watches, and then they blew a whistle, and we climbed up the trench and went out. Well, before that, they gave us two Milsons grenades we'd put in our pocket, overcoat pockets. We had overcoats on at the time. Plus another 50 rounds of ammunition slung across our shoulders. That meant we had 150 rounds of ammunition besides all our rifling equipment and everything, and a respirator across our chest. So we used to go along on having the faintest idea. We must have had about 40 or 50 pounds of equipment around us. Anyway, we went over the top, and the order was that the guns would start firing 5 minutes before we went over onto their front line trench and the wire, so that when we went over, everything should be clear, and that their front line trench would be either decimated or they'd have the reds down out of the shell fire. But anyway, we went across and got so many, about 100 yards away, that's all, and machine gun fire from the Germans on both flanks. I was with a pal of mine called Ted Freeman, big fella he was, and we were going along there, and he said, "Well, let's jump in the shell hole." There were plenty of shell holes about out of the fire, and we jumped in the shell hole and turned around facing the Germans with our rifle over the top of the shell hole. And then he said something about he saw a German, and put his rifle up to fire, and I was right alongside of him, and I felt him give a bit of a jerk and a bit of a shudder, and he'd been shot right through the heart. And then a couple of officers come along, and I couldn't see anybody else in the vicinity at all, and they told me to join another party, and we started in the afternoon, it was getting on for evening. It seemed to quieten down, and other troops came up from our own, not from our own regiment, from other regiments. And I remember a company sergeant major appeared, and he told us to start digging with our trenching tools another trench, which was like advanced to the one we'd been on, you see. And we did that, and we spent the night there and went over the top next morning again. And then we got relieved at 12 o'clock again and went back. And we had to make our own way back. And that was the drill in those days. When you went up there and when you went back, you more or less made your own way, more or less kept in touch verbally with your next door neighbour. But anyway, I went back, and must have been, I was detailed by one of the sergeants to help with a stretcher to carry it back to a first aid post. And that delayed me getting back. Anyway, eventually I arrived back. Couldn't find my own unit for some time, and it must have been nearly lunchtime, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, before I found them. And then I, in the distance, I saw one of the old army mobile kitchens, which was like a boiler on four wheels, which was pulled along by a couple of horses. And these boilers used to be lit while they were going along, and they'd brew up skilly, that stew, for the soldiers, or make tea. I saw this, and they had a large chimney, so you couldn't mistake them in the field. Saw this, and then I saw our RSM. And he was helping dish out the food. Anyway, when I got up there, I got my mess tin out, and a mug we used to always carry in it. I got this tin of skelly, and got a drop of rum, and some tea, and some bread, and told to find a bivouac and bed down for a rest. Anyway, I found one, and I must have slept for over 12 hours, because it was in the evening again before I woke up. And we stopped there another couple of days, I think. Oh, on the following day, we had I got back, we had a roll call. After every action, I always had a roll call to find out who was still alive. And in the army, you had to, the sergeant major used to go out there and call for markers. That's the right hand marker for each company. And there was nobody for B Company, so he saw me, and he knew me more or less, and he knew I belonged to B Company, so he called me over and said I was to take the right mark, and I was the only one in the company. And we stopped there that night, and then we all got into French buses, and was taken away to, I forget the name of the place, and we're going out on a 3 weeks rest after our actions on the Somme, you see.